Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service. Catch all the hard-hitting news and current affairs that focuses on all relevant First Nations issues from a First Nations standpoint. This is Bo Spearham with Let's Talk.
Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. Before I go on any further, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners on his land we are broadcasting from. I also would like to pay my respects to our elders and also our elders of more recent arrival. And a big shout out to everybody around the continent that is taking our program via the National Indigenous Radio Service, NIRS, or listening via our app, 98.9 FM, for the best country, which you can get from app stores or our website, which is 98.9 FM.com.au. Those platforms beaming us into your community. Over the last few days, I have been attending a really, really deadly conference at Gardens Point University, I think it's called. I'm not up to, you know, which is which university. I was just over on the other side of the river meeting some deadly mob. Yesterday on the program, I had Brenda Croft, who is involved in some very, very important work with her mob back home in the Gurindji country, language revitalization, putting together some books with some mob back in her community, but then also doing some deadly work on this side of the country. There's actually been some really, really good panels and discussions that has been taking place over there. I'm going to head back over there a little bit later. A brother that I interviewed last year, Indy Clark from Crew Youth Council, is attending and speaking about his work, working with young Koori mob Victorians down there. So I'm going to catch up with him. Also, I want to get his thoughts on NAIDOC as well, and, you know, what is the perspective from younger mob down in Victoria in the discussion of treaty. But joining me in the studio, I have a very, very deadly guest from Canada as well, and somewhat of a familiar face and voice to our listeners here on 98.9 FM. So just before we start, could I get you to tell us your name, your mob, and where you're from, please?
I'm Kiara Ladner, and I come from a res in South Saskatchewan. My grandfather's reserve called Niganit in Cypress Hill, Saskatchewan, over in Canada, Treaty 6 land.
Mm-hmm. And it was a surprise on my behalf because I didn't think I'd, you know, see you again from when we first met. I think it was in 2015 when you were over here for a conference, and you came on this program as well. You've been on this program several times as well.
Yeah.
We bumped into each other yesterday at one of the sessions that Brett Levy gave about his virtual world that he's creating and putting together. He has been for years. When he used to head up NIRS here upstairs, you'd always see him sort of tweaking it at his desk and working on it more, and it's great to see the progression of what it is today. We bumped into each other in that session. What did you think of that session?
That was amazing. Absolutely stunning to see how VR can be used to really honor our ancestors.
Definitely.
I'd love to see something like that done on my territory.
Mm-hmm.
But to see Brisbane shown the idea of the day before Invasion Day.
Yeah, contact. Yeah.
That was absolutely stunning to see what the city could have looked like, what it would have looked like.
Mm.
And to honor those people that went before and fought so hard from that very day forward.
Yeah.
It would be wonderful to see different generations picked up so that one can see the progression.
Definitely.
And what different generations have done and the love that different generations have given us to be in this place now. Your people surely love this land and have done so much on this land to ensure the survival of people and to thrive today. And if more people knew those stories, I think that it would fill young people's hearts.
Definitely it would. And I think that that platform that he has at the moment with what he's doing, you know, I asked the question, I said, oh, you know, what is the purpose of this? And he said, oh, I'm just making it. It's whatever, you know, the user's purpose wants it to be, you know. And it was amazing to sort of see how he broke it down as well, like how he made it, you know, how did he get the land back to what it was and using different satellites and all these other different things he was talking about. And, you know, it was really, really awesome. And yeah, if you're really interested in checking that out, just I'm sure Google Brett Levy and his virtual world that he's creating. He's doing it in Brisbane, Sydney, Adelaide, I think Tasmania, Western Australia, Melbourne, so all the major cities, and he's doing it the day before each contact. So Sydney would be, you know, well over 250 years before Cook. I don't know the exact time of when they came here. It would have been in the maybe early 1800s. Would have got here in Brisbane and, you know, different times in other places. But, yeah, the sort of how he's pinpointed it back to then and, you know, built each individual up and, yeah, especially that part where he got the dancers in.
Yeah.
And they put, like, the 3D suit on or whatever it was, and then they did Garen and Army. I thought that was awesome.
That's absolutely amazing use of technology. And it looks, you know, our kids are so used to playing video games. And to have that kind of imagery set before them to teach about, you know, if this was on my land, who we are as that history.
Yeah.
That's... teaches where kids are today.
And it stays in, I guess, in line of, you know, what we are as storytellers as well. It's just sort of changing how we tell that story, which is amazing as well. Is there anything like that back home?
I've never seen anything like that.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to go home and talk to a few people.
Yeah.
Say, you gotta check this guy out.
Definitely.
It's just tremendous to watch. I watched there was a lab down at Monash in Melbourne who have done a similar really interesting video game, or using a video game software to do, I can't even remember the town.
It's a
town, ancient town in Asia, somewhere.
Yeah.
I want to say Kuala Lumpur, but I'm absolutely wrong. I didn't pay enough attention to it. I was paying attention to what computer-generated learning could do.
Yeah.
So they put all these people into this town, gave certain people responsibilities or tasks, and looked to see what they thought the town could have looked like 3,000 years ago.
Based upon
historic sites and references. These things could be a groundswell of activity to show also how things, you know, you teach a couple tasks and other bots in here could actually learn and it could generate both coastal and inland. And that would be cool.
Definitely.
And to see trading and because, you know, would have been cool to see governance, you know.
Yeah.
I'm all into governance, as you
definitely,
know.
Definitely, yes.
And to see dance and culture is one thing. But to remind people that our ancestors had everything, had law, had politics, had social space, had everything. And that's something to add, I think.
For sure. Certainly didn't get you on to talk about video games and all that. But it was, you know, every time I see it, it always amazes me just, you know, how much the progression of it has just changed as well. Just my partner just texted me. Our daughter, she dropped our daughter off to daycare her first day. I was like, oh, bub, can you, like, send me a video? And she's like, oh, no, I didn't want to send a video because I'd get upset or she'd get upset or our baby girl's her first day of daycare today. So my partner just dropped her off and said she just ran and just went and played the toys.
Aw.
So that's good.
How old?
She's two. She's two. Nali is her name, means stingray. Yes, I've got a 5-month-old. I think I would have been more emotional than what my partner would have been if I would have dropped her off.
When does it know whether to cry?
Sorry?
When does it know whether to cry, when they just want to run off and play with others, or whether to be happy at that point?
Yeah, that's
point,
it. Yeah. Definitely happy for her. I've certainly got you on to have a yarn about the work that you do. You're a professor at the University of Manitoba, and I cannot pronounce the name of the unit that you work in it, but you're part of the Department of Political Studies, Yeah, can you tell us a bit about your work?
Yeah,
and the unit that you're part of.
I teach in political science or political studies at Manitoba, but I run a research center that we call Mamawipuan, which is a Cree word for where we gather, the place that we gather. It's a gathering place. And I built it, kind of like the field of dreams, build it and something will happen. Mm-hmm. I built a round room thinking, you know, we'll gather and start talking about governance and something, you know, we'll put tech in and put a server in, and didn't really know what we were going to do. We were just going to do something different for community, community-engaged scholarship. And I've ended up working on some big databases and digital archives and on missing and murdered women, which is a huge thing in Canada as well as here, and then post-apology residential school, so looking at all of the media archive related to residential schools in Canada and after Harper apologized in the TRC. So that media was never being collected. And so we've done a digital library which is going to be cast out to both community to be able to learn from, but also to start to educate and continue to educate white fellas about residential school. And the space is really just a round room that people gather in and talk research. So we bring in students, we bring in community, other faculty, and right now we're working on a big project, another project on missing murdered women. There's a ARCA, or a set of vamps, the moccasin tops that went across Canada. They were collected by an artist, Christy Belcourt, and made by women across the country, actually across the world, and beaded. A beautiful collection called Walking with Our Sisters. And Walking with Our Sisters, as an installation, is ending this year. All the vamps are either going back to their makers or being put in a ceremonial fire. And so we're doing a crowdsourced archive, which will show all the vamps, will allow families to come on and talk about the loved ones that the vamps were made for, will allow the makers to come in and talk about them, but will also allow families just to commemorate and honor the loved ones, our missing women and girls. So that's what we do right now, and as well as my work here working on treaties and constitutions. So,
Very important issues that, you know, I guess the unit that you have created works on, and I guess credit to the space that you've created as well, because institutions within themselves can be very triggering and damaging, and I guess has their setbacks in terms of, you know, our mob as Indigenous folks around the world trying to progress or trying to sort of approach, you know, our stories from our communities as well. They have their setbacks in these institutions, but creating that space, you know, has given, I guess, that energy to sort of do the work that you have been doing.
Yeah. I think that there's been few institutions that have really stepped up, but increasingly we're seeing institutions are had a chance to talk with folks from Griffith yesterday that are also doing some similar work and really just trying to support better research. And I just came from NASA, the Native American Indigenous Studies Conference, over in Waikato with almost 2,000 scholars, mostly Aboriginal from around the world, with some allies. But really the focus is on Indigenous-led scholarship. And it was phenomenal to see how far we've come in 20 and 30 years. When I started in the Academy 20 years ago, there was a handful of PhDs. I didn't ever once get to take a course in Indigenous anything. And now you can take huge whole programs in Indigenous studies, and it's fascinating to see the development.
Definitely.
And it's so good for our communities to have research that is good, but also research that I think, focuses on the real interests of our communities. Mm-hmm. That it used to be that, you know, people would go away and steal knowledge. And today I think that people come back and try and show off their knowledge in different ways and and drive with community these projects. So it's a big change.
It is. Like, even out before the program started and the Brekkie Show was going, we were just talking about, you know, sort of the sacrifices, you know, and I guess the doors open, the elders that sort of opened doors and sort of led us into where we are. And we sort of spoke about, you know, how different it was, you know, for older generations. And like you said, like with yourself, you know, there wasn't really these avenues when you first started over 20, 30 years ago. But now, you know, younger folks, especially, you know, younger folks over your way, having the opportunity to sort of study, you know, I guess what it is to be Indigenous, or, you know, breaking down, you know, really focusing in on the issues that actually affect our communities as well. How important is that as well, you know, now that there is sort of these avenues for, you know, all these people now?
I think it's tremendously important if we do research that matters. I think that all research can matter. I know that I laugh about people. Well, I can't say I laugh. I wonder why people study things like classics, the Greek classics. Hasn't everything ever been written about them? Can't we move on and study other things that have not? But I think today we see so much research that actually matters. Like the video programming yesterday. Like the work on data sovereignty. Mm-hmm. So a couple panels yesterday. I flew in for those panels simply because the idea that community needs and gets and owns the access to all of our data matters. It matters to community, but it matters that research matters because then we can make better public policy. And we have a lot of self-government ideas in communities, land councils here. Without good research, they can't make decisions. Mm-hmm. Without knowing how many members that they have, education levels, they can't start thinking about what kind of tertiary education programs that they need. Mm-hmm. So even just knowing how many students you have, attainment levels, let alone healthcare data, that really starts to matter. So when we get to see research on language revitalization and what types of programming works and what's working best in a community in Tasmania that could be then brought into a community in Tuktoyaktuk in the Northern Territories and in Canada, that type of research I think can really drive change. Mm-hmm. So to me, it's all about driving change. Mm-hmm. But listening to community, responding to people's needs, and then coming back with a product that at the end of the day is really geared towards community.
Definitely. And the work that you're over here for and you have been coming back for around governance, around treaty, has put you in a place, I guess, over here to sort of be a part of or witness some of the discussions around those things in this part of the country, in this part of the world, I should say. You being from your part of the world, from Canada, you know, generations ago, you know, is when they sort of had these treaties, you know, centuries ago. We're only just starting to hit the tip of the discussions here. And well, I guess, what's your thoughts around some of the discussions that have been had over here? But then also, I guess, your lived experience through having, you know, growing up with treaties around, what are some of the interesting discussions that have been had so far over here around treaties?
I'll just tell your audience a bit about our treaty and then I'll answer the question. Our treaty was signed in 1876. In South Central, well, north central Saskatchewan, at a place called Fort Pitt and Fort Carlton. And we'd lobbied for that treaty for about 6 years, using, you know, at the time, missionaries and other things to go back and forth to government. And we had a vision of what should be that treaty. We had a vision of how do we live 7 generations in the future. Mm. And I think those grandfathers and the grandmothers that thought through that process were really thinking with love, how do you get that generation, 7 generations forward to live? What kind of tools do they need? And so our treaty was about changing an economy.
Mm.
We were moving from buffalo people. The buffalo were people knew that they were dying. They were nearing extinction. And so the treaty asked for, one, people to stop killing all the buffalo, to protect them from the government, to protect them from American hunters and strychnine and other things.
Mm.
But it also talked about how do we live and prosper as people in the future. So agriculture was a big thing. So our treaty talks about getting assistance to agriculture, getting assistance with school, getting assistance with a whole lot of things that in 1876 made sense, and $5 a year for sharing the land.
Mm.
But it really was about a relationship and a relationship to prosper in the future.
Mm.
The government saw it simply as buying our land,
mm-hmm.
you know, as governments do. It was we refer to it as a big lie day.
Yeah.
Because the government saw it as one thing, we saw it as another thing.
Mm.
The government still pays us $5 a year as a sale for the land, in their mind. We see that as a relationship. We still go and shake a Mountie's hand, dressed up in their nice serge, their beautiful days, and still do that every year to celebrate that.
Mm-hmm.
And to honor that it's supposed to be a relationship between two nations.
Mm.
Here, we're starting generations after that. And I think that the government has listened and picked up what has been called for generations and generations for treaty. You know, there's Larissa Barrett's book on treaty. There's been calls for treaty for 30, 40, 50, 60, 100 years, probably more than that. And so the government's picked up on that, but isn't really, in my mind, listening to that discourse that had been going on.
Mm.
They seem to think that the treaty could be, you know, negotiated on a state level or a nation level, one nation a number of people are calling for a national treaty. But at the state level, doing one treaty in Victoria with a treaty council. But the treaty council may not, if a treaty is between two nations, how can it be with the treaty council?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not necessarily the same sort of treaty as people like Larissa Barrett were talking about and elders previously. That doesn't mean that it's not a treaty and not something to go for. It's just something to do, maybe take caution to.
Mm.
That it's not like the Treaty of Waitangi in New Zealand or Treaty 6 in Canada or the Gaswanda, that treaty between the Mohawks and the Crown. Our treaties are nation to nation.
Mm.
The treaties here, well, maybe between nations, plural, and a state. And a state can make treaties. There's nothing to say that it can't.
Mm-hmm.
But I think one has to be cautious. I don't know if that fully answered your question, but it's they're different beasts. The treaty process here, I think, also is trying to deal with things more narrowly.
Yeah.
And maybe it's time to actually start with the building blocks and talk about the treaty as that new relationship, as starting a new relationship. And maybe that's what the treaties can offer. I'm not sure.
I
spent a lot of time in Victoria the last couple of years. The last year, I had spent a year and a half of not traveling to Australia after taking 4 and 5 trips a year for 10 years. But I've been watching from afar and now talking to people like Lydia Thorpe, as well as land councils and treaty organizers in Victoria. And I'm a bit cautious. But I still think that treaty offers every opportunity. It's about how one uses that treaty. And I'm interested to see what that treaty council can do.
Definitely. And I guess since, and using your mob and I guess the treaty that you have gone through as well, was that with Canada or the Crown?
It was with the Crown because only the Crown – well, it's with Canada. Because Canada had already become a nation. But treaties were signed with the Crown, so the treaty was signed – 1876, Canada didn't have foreign affairs yet. And so the treaty was negotiated with the Crown and Right of Canada. It was really Canada that did it. Don't tell our mob that. We signed with the Queen, Queen Victoria. Our mob still thinks of it as a treaty between her people and our people. It's a very different idea than signing with the state.
Definitely.
So,
and when did things were they automatically enacted or were they sort of not enacted until some time later, or was there always this process of that treaty being honoured, or were there instances where it wasn't? And, because these are things that happen, and these are sort of, I guess, questions that, come up when we think of having a treaty with any, with whatever state it may be here or the government, because those are some of the big questions as well.
The treaty, in my mind, was never honored. We have a clause for assistance during pestilence and starvation, often thought about as a ration clause. The buffalo were dying off. By 1883, the buffalo were essentially gone. So 1876, we sign. 1883, there's not a buffalo left in our territory. And everything that we lived off of was related to the buffalo. They were our skins for our lodges. They were the meat that we ate. They were our brothers. And so there was also a huge mourning that went with that. The government wanted to clear the land. So they thought that they bought the land. They in many regards, stole that land. And I would say that they stole that land. Because the treaty was about sharing the land and sharing a plow blade deep of land. From a Cree perspective, they got to use a plow blade deep, put up fences, and that we would not molest them, and that they would be governed by their own crown and their own government, and we would have our own government. 1885, there was a war in my territory led by the sons of the signatories. And there was a war because the government already by 1885 was using food rations to clear the plains. If you went to your reserve, you would get food. But then they didn't even give food once you got to the reserve. And there's a book called Clearing the Plains that came out a few years ago from University of Regina Press. Phenomenal book that talks about the federal government's plan to clear the plains basically by forced starvation. And so this idea that we had ration houses on reserve four times the pestilence and starvation was BS. The farm equipment, they took away our children, Yes, they gave us some farm equipment, but they took away our children and sent them to residential schools. They outlawed our ceremonies. They did everything that we see having done here in many ways were done in Canada despite treaties.
Mm.
So to get them to honor the treaty, we had to move towards the Constitution in 1982. So my grandfather's generation and went towards the Constitution and got Canada was opening up its Constitution. And so they went at it and got Aboriginal treaty rights enshrined in Canada's Constitution. And so the government legally has an obligation to uphold these treaties. And now we have some way to go to court over these treaties.
Mm.
And that's been the biggest thing is if a treaty is to be signed, you need some way of upholding that law.
And
we all know that governments don't honor their promises to Aboriginal people.
Mm.
And so that issue of accountability, we need, even today, even though we have the Constitution, this past 2 years we've been sitting with the Trudeau government talking about creating a mechanism of accountability of how do you hold the government to account on issues of treaty rights, on issues of Aboriginal rights, on their dealing with First Nations. So huge, complex issues. Sorry that there's no nice, clear, wonderful answer.
No, that's all good. That's all good. And I guess, you know, this can go into sort of, I guess, the broader discussions of individual nations or, you know, nations coming together to have that discussion with states or, you know, with the nation as well. And I remember a few years ago in Canada, there was a big uproar and a movement out of it called Island No More started. And that was because the changing, was that around the Constitution as well? One of the bills in terms of water rights, I think it was?
Yeah. There was a, under the Harper government, there was a piece of legislation that was a budget bill, but it was like three big binders thick.
Mm.
It covered legislation. It was, Harper was, it was kind of our Bush.
Yeah.
Really not, it was like many of your prime ministers, very right wing, very anti Aboriginal.
Ain't they all? No.
Yep. this guy said that Canada had no history of colonialism.
Mm.
Like, what boat did he come off of is really my question. Where did his people come from?
Mm.
But, he had this omnibus bill that did away with environmental protections, did away with water rights, did away with so many rights and so many government policies, did away with researchers in every unit of government. So we would have a department of health with no health researchers. Just completely wasted government.
Lying. Yeah.
And so Idle No More started as a response because a land with no environmental protections is a land where more of our ancestors, more of our brothers and sisters, that being our trees, our mountains, our those non-human beings are being destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And to see more land destroyed, people stood up.
Yeah.
And they used it as a vehicle about the Harper government to start with, but it really was a call, and it lasted for several years. We still see glimmers of it today, but it really was a call to action and a call to educate this next generation. I really hated the name of it, Idle No More, because we've never been idle.
Yeah.
Your people have never been idle. Mm. Even by sitting down on the land and telling a story, that's not being an idol. So they occupied malls and did demonstrations in malls. They simply turned on or started some drums, sang, and did round dances. minus 45 weather, shutting down streets in Toronto and Winnipeg, minus 45 Celsius, damn cold weather, shutting down streets and protesting in honor of the land. That was pretty damn cool.
Definitely was. And how did they get around, you know, stopping that? Was that sort of something obviously to do with the outcry of people, but was there some sort of protection clause within the Constitution under, like, their treaty rights that sort of protected that as well? Or because it was legislative?
They didn't get to stop it.
Yeah, they didn't get to stop it, yeah.
But Idle No More, I think, also led to was one of those contributing factors that led to Trudeau getting elected. So we've now had 3.5 years or almost 4 years of a Trudeau government. And I think that Idle No More raised the awareness of Canadians on what Harper was doing. So Idle No More had sit-ins and teach-ins and led to, I think, a total rebirth of Canadians having to face themselves. With the TRC report come out just after Idle No More, the Truth and Reconciliation, dealing with residential schools, coming out with comments on genocide, and coming out with a platform of reconciliation where people needed, their idea of reconciliation wasn't a rap, but was that Canadians actually need to learn their history. And I think that I see linkages between the ground laying, the preparation done by Idle No More, that the TRC couldn't do something lame. They had to do something big. So 94 recommendations that focus on everything from transforming primary school education, kindergarten and on, year one on, to law degrees, social work, the way government works. Is it happening? We see a lot of change. We see a lot of Canadians now recognizing territory or recognizing country. That never happened before. I don't know if that really will ever make a difference. I kind of doubt it. But I think that when kids grow up thinking and knowing that they're on someone else's land, maybe that will make a difference in that future generation. Maybe they'll be better apt to talk to Aboriginal people in a different way. Maybe they'll be a more willing 97% to actually deal with Aboriginal people on a nation-to-nation basis. 'Cause when you're stuck with a majority, like in this country, where that 97% are the voters that vote for their government to recognize or not recognize Aboriginal rights or treaty rights or create a constitution, it's that 97% that we have to educate.
That's it. And, you know, I'm sure there's that small, you know, group of that 97% that may be, you know, the converted or, you know, allies and whatnot. But, yeah, there's that majority that sort of need that understanding as well. And you did mention, you know, through those movements within Canada, that sort of was the voting block, I guess, to get people like Trudeau in. But obviously, you know, that's as far as it goes, I guess, in terms of, you know, changing the way people think, and obviously there needs to be more around that as well. And I guess, you know, how do you change that? Like you said, you know, obviously that comes back down to education in schools. Is there much around history, you know, real history being taught in schools other than universities when you, I guess, pick those elected sort of programs?
When I first started teaching in 2000, I was always shocked that no one knew anything.
Same here.
And now I'm more shocked when people walk into a classroom and know something. And I think the last 5 years in Canada, I see a massive swell of shifting. And so I don't have to start with the basics.
Yeah.
I don't have to start with, you know, colonialism happened. I don't have to start with treaties. I can actually start with some bigger discussions and talking about resurgence, why resurgence, but also talking about what their responsibilities are. And that's been huge. It's much easier to talk to people that don't think that a treaty acknowledgement means that someone's going to come and take their land back. Mm-hmm. Because those beliefs still exist.
Definitely, definitely.
Like, I dated someone this year that had that understanding. Woke me up at 4 o'clock in the morning and said, you know, this treaty acknowledgement. Like, I don't want to have to pay for my house again. What the hell? We can tell that relationship didn't work out. But you get less and less and less of that. Mm. And more understanding that, you know, there has to be a different scheme for it. I don't know what will that look like. We have many academics working on thinking through a different relationship. We have activists like yourself working on figuring out what a different relationship will be like. And who knows what it'll be like. It just has to be different.
Definitely. You know, people may think some of those ideas are too radical to sort of go into the discussion of treaty and all these things, which is sad to think, because folks, Indigenous people in our position, are worth more than what we have, than what we've been given, and certainly what we've been, and certainly how we've been treated. You know, so for people to say, you know, certain ideas are too radical, you know, is quite, you know, sad. You know, is there thoughts, you know, back home of sort of rediscussing how, you know, treaties look back home, like going through these discussions and having, you know, more dialogue with government saying, hey, we want to change some things?
There is. And surprisingly, I, 2 years ago, sat across the table from the Minister of Indian Affairs, the Minister of Colonialism in my book.
Is he Indigenous?
No.
Well, all the years that there's been that portfolio in government, this is the first year we've had an Indigenous person as the Indigenous Affairs Minister. The name's changed. It's still that same portfolio.
Yeah. Yeah. Ours is now the Crown Indigenous Relations portfolio.
Okay, yeah.
An Indigenous person was offered that portfolio in a cabinet shuffle recently, Jody Raybould Wilson, or Wilson Raybould. And she said no, she couldn't do it.
Mm.
She couldn't be the one in charge of the Indian Act, the one in charge of our colonization.
But
what I was going to say is about 2 years ago, I got called to a meeting with the Department of Justice and Crown Indigenous Relations, Indian Affairs. And I was really shocked when I was absolutely flabbergasted and gobsmacked when she opened her mouth, talking about a relationship, talking about creating accountability for holding the government to account on its implementation of treaties. And I went, holy shit, did this woman – sorry, maybe not said that.
Not all people have said that.
But, like, this woman, the Crown, the government is actually reading what we're writing.
Mm.
They're listening to our elders. They're doing something. And so, you know, I've been hit hard on the idea that this Trudeau government had on moving forward, negotiating and the implementation of treaties today, and what those treaties mean, because it wasn't just $5 a year or axe and a plow and a bag of wheat seed. Mm. It was about a relationship and about
coexistence
on the same land.
Yeah.
And sharing that land and sharing its resources. And so it's been interesting to see government actually respond and government go forward. Mm. Was it the best plan? No, their plan failed.
Mm.
And it failed because it really failed to engage with community in the co-development of the plan.
Mm.
And
or maybe that was just the way that they wanted things to play out as well.
Absolutely. I do think that there was a lot of that. But it was it showed, I think, some real movement.
Yeah.
And what used to be radical, this idea of having, you know, we could get a Waitangi tribunal in Canada or something similar, is now being discussed in the mainstream. Treaty implementation. When I started writing about treaties when I was in first year university, people would say that this is a pipe dream. That, like, this is nonsense. I think that I got the word nonsense written on many things. Now, the things that I write or wrote 20 years ago are now mainstream. So things that were radical 20 years ago are now mainstream in university. So is something too radical? We got to keep being radical. We got to keep dreaming and pushing. And pushing with the love of seven generations. Are we going to get rid of the state? I think that we have to realize that the state can change. Are we going to get rid of it? Possibly not. Colonialism is here to stay, but I think we can alter the effect of colonialism. Not make it softer for our people, but make it about coexistence rather than a settler state. But I think that that's what treaty could do. And you guys have an opportunity to think through treaty today and that new relationship today.
Use examples as well from back your home. And
we don't get to renegotiate. Or maybe we will, but I don't think anyone wants to renegotiate. We just want it implemented.
Yeah.
But you guys get to negotiate a new relationship. And I think that going out onto the streets for Sorry Day and going out to the streets for Invasion Day and demanding and causing Australians to rumble in their seats is what's going to do it. Causing this idea of economic insecurity for a country would do it. Yeah, go and protest in Western Australia and shut down the highways that are owned by the NRK and other companies. That would do it. Get a whole lot of people arrested. I'm not suggesting anyone go out and do anything illegal. Would never suggest that, right? But protesting in the streets and creating some instability would actually cause the government to act, I think, and to maybe think about a relationship differently. But it's about people on the streets and the clans getting back. You know, we talk about nation rebuilding. You know, what's the treaty worth when we don't know what we want? And I hear that a lot. Those are probably the words that I hear the most. You know, I don't understand this treaty. I don't understand the Constitution. We don't really know what we want. Well, I think it's time for those conversations again. And not amongst the academics. I'm sure that we can help. But in community. I think that someone like Lydia Thorpe is right to say that, you know, maybe we have to stall this process a bit and allow the clans time to say what is a treaty, what is the purpose of a treaty, and what do we want out of a treaty. And I think that Lydia might be onto something. She's also really onto this idea of treaties with local governments. So those people that occupy your land, that there has to be a relationship between that mob and your mob. And I think that's maybe local treaties is a way to go.
Definitely. And I think, you know, there is no better time than now, especially next year being 250 years of the arrival of the Endeavour. And Captain Cook claiming the east coast of Australia. arriving in Botany Bay down in New South Wales. Yeah, next year marks 250 years. 2020, it'll be a really good time to sort of, from now, to get involved in this discussion and, you know, really rethink how we want to see the next 250 years or, like you said, the next seven generations or, you know, get involved in the discussion that need to be had, you know, on coexistence or, you know, what does a treaty look like and or treaties look like amongst our nations.
I think it's a time to dream.
Definitely.
You know,
definitely.
It's Canada celebrated 150th birthday in 2017, and Myra Tate, who I used to work with, and I did a book called Surviving Canada.
Yeah.
And I think that we have to celebrate that survival.
Definitely.
But we also have to dream and dream forward.
Mm-hmm.
I talk about treaty being a dream for seven generations later from that love of those ancestors.
Mm.
What is it that people want to leave their ancestors? What does it look like for the next seven generations? And I think that those are the conversations that need to really happen.
Yeah,
and I urge people to have. But at the same time, celebrate. Celebrate, not cook, but celebrate survival.
Mm.
Flip the celebration on its head. Surviving cook. It's not 250 years since cook. It's 250 years of survival. And celebrate something different. It is a day of mourning. And it's a celebrating that mourning. I don't know if that makes sense, but
that does.
When the idea of the book being titled "Surviving Canada," celebrating 150 years of resistance came up, I thought it was kind of a play, and a nice play. Mm. That we're surviving, but we're also celebrating that survival.
Mm.
And it's a reaction. It's not in line with the dialogue of Canada, and it shouldn't be in line with the dialogue of Australia. It's also a good time to push for treaty, 250 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And as Australians have to reckon with that, force them to reconcile themselves. Reconciliation shouldn't be a rat plan. It should be Australians really being forced to reconcile themselves. I look at Keating's remarks in Redfern.
Mm-hmm. Or blackfellas having to do the work.
Yeah.
You know, to reconcile.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, and the thing that's being left out of, you know, the whole reconciliation thing is the truth behind what happened.
Yeah.
And the honesty of what took place as well. And you know, the honesty that's left out, you know, is the reason why we're in the position that we're in today. And that needs to be discussed.
Absolutely.
Mm.
It's a denial of 250 years.
It's a history. It's a narrative and, you know, could say it's a culture. You know, it's some people's birthrights.
Absolutely.
That's all they know. I want to say a big thanks for coming and joining us on the program this morning. We could just keep yarning in that there, but can't, sadly. But thank you for joining us on the program and being a part of, you know, discussions over here with Mob, in terms of being somebody in the know, in terms of how it feels to live in a society where, you know, there has been negotiations and there has been treaties, but then also in a position to keep people honest as well.
Yeah.
Which is what we all need.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Let's Talk here on 98.9 FM.